From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, June the 16th, 2020, and we have a good lined up for you today. We're going to be speaking first with Governor Phil Scott. He's joining us for the first half hour of the program this morning. Second up will be Steve Pappas, the editor and publisher of the Times Argus. He's going to share with us some important news about that newspaper. And then in the later hour, we're going to be joined by Craig Pinkham of the Washington County Youth Service Bureau and Linda Johnson of Prevent Child Abuse Vermont, and they are going to talk to us about the special challenges of working with some of Vermont's more vulnerable kids during the pandemic, as in how do you meet with people and try to help families out, et cetera. You got to do it all virtually by phone, apparently, and sets up some challenges. So we're going to be talking to Linda Johnson and Craig Pinkham about that in the second hour of the program. I'm sure that'll be interesting as well. I think we're also going to have a little conversation with one of our CBS News correspondents about the latest news on police violence and protests, et cetera, elsewhere in the country. There was that shooting in Atlanta the other night that is now the latest, causing sort of the latest round of outrage out there. And but I wanted to get right into it with Governor Phil Scott. I believe he's on the phone with us this morning. And Governor, thank you very much for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
So looks like the sort of headline news is that you have extended the state of emergency in Vermont in for another month here, June 15th to July 15th. And it sounds like from your briefing yesterday, the main goal there is just to give yourself and other state officials the sort of flexibility to continue basically tweaking the systems here and turning the knobs or the spigot, as you call it, with a certain degree of flexibility, I guess. Do I have that roughly right?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it was just 3 months ago that we issued the state of emergency, and that put in motion a lot of initiatives. We closed a lot of businesses, closed schools, put a lot of restrictions on most of us in some respects. And so now we need to continue to open up back up, do it in a methodical way that doesn't adversely impact Vermonters. So to do that, we need a mechanism to make sure that we continue to open up slowly, methodically, again, in a way that that is helpful to Vermonters and doesn't do undue harm, and does it in a way so we don't have to retreat. So we do this, again, slowly, methodically, open things up, and that way, if something comes up, we have multiple outbreaks, we might have to slow down a little bit. But if everything continues to move in the direction that we're moving now, we'll be able to open up and get back to some sort of normal in the not too distant future.
I know one key goal is getting schools open again in the fall, but it sounds to me like that's going to be a tough realm to get back completely to normal. I actually had, I've heard discussions about school sports and how are football and basketball and other sports going to work. And then yesterday I had on a couple of music educators who were just talking about the difficulty of, like, you know, running a band when you can't really maintain 6 feet of social distancing with the person you're sharing a music stand with, and it's pretty tough to blow into a trombone through a face mask. So, yeah. I mean, I don't mean to make light of this stuff.
No. They're all good points. But I think what we have to do is open up our minds, become more creative. I've seen so much creativity over the last couple of months by entities, individuals, and trying to find ways to get back to normal and understanding that this is a big step. But again, if we continue to see positive trends, we'll be able to safely reopen schools in the fall. And I think that this will be beneficial, not just for kids and schools, but and their ability to learn, but also for our state of mind. I think we just need to do something to get back to normal. So I don't think there's any replacement for in-person instruction. You know, we've seen where teachers and administrators have done a really good job with remote learning, especially without a lot of planning. But it just, you know, you can't beat that in-person instruction and the social benefits as well of being in school. So I think we'll get there, but we're just going to have to be careful and think about this and be all at the table and set out those guidelines that everyone can adhere to, whether it's the, you know, partners with the Department of Health, the Agency of Education, superintendents, the teachers, the NEA, and other principals and others. Just making sure that we contemplate all the different paths we'll have to take.
In terms of getting Vermont's economy back going again, I hear a lot of concerns from folks, for instance, in the restaurant industry, in the lodging industry, you know, two industries that are so crucial due to Vermont's, you know, high level of tourism in normal times. I'm wondering, you know, what kind of comfort can you give to a restaurateur who says, I'm supposed to open, or I can open up, but I'm supposed to do so at very limited capacity. I was already a fairly, you know, I had a very tight financial picture previous to the pandemic, and the puzzle pieces just aren't fitting together as I look ahead here. How do you sort of get that person to have a little more comfort?
Yeah, I definitely sympathize with them. I was in the restaurant business for a while myself, understand the challenges associated with that and how tight the margins are, but how tight they were before and how incredibly difficult it is at this point through no fault of their own. This isn't any of their doing. This is something, it's not, you know, I'm not taking the blame for this either. We're just trying to manage this to keep people healthy. And I don't think any of us should be surprised at the incredible impact this has had on our economy. But I believe we've made the right decisions, put public health first and foremost. And we've seen some positive trends as a result of what we've done. And so we've been able to start to reopen on the economy, and we'll continue to do so as we see these positive trends continue. We're now, you know, it wasn't that long ago that all restaurants and bars and lodging were closed down completely. Lodging's opened up to 50%. We've allowed for outdoor dining, and then we just opened up indoor dining to 25%. It won't be long before we'll go to 50% and then get back again to somewhere near normal. But that's why this economic package that I presented to the legislature is so important, a $400 million package that will provide for financial assistance, grants, and so forth to some of these hospitality industry folks that need it. Agriculture is another sector that we need to pay attention to. So many of these businesses, small businesses in Vermont, are right on the brink of disaster. They can't make it much longer. We received this CARES money, $1.25 billion, and part of that money is supposed to, you know, part of it is for the emergency itself, but the other part is to help us recover from this, you know, make some economic recovery here. We're pushing forward with that. The legislature released a part of that money, about a quarter to a third of it. So we're hopeful they'll take it back up so we can get it in the hands of those who need it, because we need them. You know, when this is over, they are our bread and butter, so to speak. They're the ones that the lifeblood of state government is having this revenue come into the coffers so that we can disperse it in ways to help people. But if they're not in business, we're not going to, this is going to be a systemic financial issue for years to come if we don't give them relief right now.
Speaking of agriculture, do I understand correctly that the prospects are leaning harder toward loans than grants for instance, our dairy farmers? And given that they were already in some dire financial straits before the pandemic and have obviously taken a big hit since then, do you think that they'll be able to pay off these loans, or would it be better to try to fashion the program based more on grants?
Yeah, obviously, we want to give out as many grants as possible, and grants are preferable to loans, but there's only so much money to disperse. So we want to make sure it goes as long, as far as possible. In fact, the guidance has changed since some of the package that we put out. It changes from the federal government almost on a weekly basis. So it doesn't look like the loans are as advantageous as once thought. But again, it'll be a combination.
Worst case scenario. I mean, you've talked about planning for the worst, hoping for the best, planning for the worst, and that is obviously a fairly well acknowledged strategy in any kind of a crisis, really. God forbid anything should happen to you, say vis-a-vis the coronavirus or whatever. But one thing I've noticed that in a lot of your briefings is that I haven't seen much evidence of the lieutenant governor there. And that strikes me as different from the involvement that you had in the Shumlin administration, for instance. Is that a conscious thing? Is there any reason for that? Well, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I don't think I had any real role in the Shumlin administration.
Weren't you in cabinet meetings and so on? And
I was invited to go. I went to like two or three of them in the beginning, but it wasn't really that beneficial for me or others for me to be there. It didn't allow them to have conversations that they needed to have. You know, a cabinet is different, as I found. It's about your most trusted advisors, people that share your common goals and trying to work together. We have cabinet meetings every single week, mine are fairly active with me as playing a role in them. With the Shumlin administration, it wasn't the same. They had them like monthly, and the governor wasn't always there. And for the most part, run by Secretary of Administration, Chief of Staff, and so forth. So I just chosen a different path, but I believe in teamwork. I need people who share my same goals, my commitment to my goals. Our cabinet meetings, we aren't always on the same page when we begin, but in the end, we are. And it allows people to voice, whether it's support or opposition, give our points of view. And I just need that team to stick together in order to do that. And it doesn't, I look back on what when I was lieutenant governor, I did a lot of things on my own. As you remember, my program where I went out and worked a day in someone else's shoes and did a number of those jobs. And that was something that was really beneficial to me and gave me a different perspective. But that wasn't anything I did with the Shumlin administration. It was something I did on my own.
Yeah. Bouncing around a little bit here, but one question I had about the COVID response.
Go ahead. I'm not sure that Howard Dean was part of Richard Snelling's cabinet either, by the way.
I haven't actually gone back through the whole, modern history of this, but I just, for some reason, I sort of had the impression that Governor Shumlin did try to open the door to you, maybe more. And in fact, that struck me as being, somewhat unusual. So you're probably right the funny thing, of course, in Vermont is we have two different parties often in the two roles of governor and lieutenant governor. So two different, political platforms. I understand all that. And of course, Governor Douglas and Brian Doobie were the same political party. So they didn't have any of that sort of possible tension or just differences in goals and so on. So I do understand that. So, but I wanted to. By the way, folks, I should mention Governor Phil Scott's my guest here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and we do welcome your phone calls if the phone starts ringing. I'll try to get a guest or two on the line with you as well, Governor, before our half hour is up here. And the phone number is at 244-1777. That's the local number in Waterbury. We have a toll-free number, which is 877-291-8255. And I do believe we have Ruth from Sheldon on the line. Good morning, Ruth.
I heard your press conference last Friday, Governor Scott, and I thought you gave an excellent presentation about the severity of the economic crisis for small businesses. And I really support your $400 million get that money out to the people. And I don't understand why the democratically controlled legislature is fooling around with this, because you made it perfectly clear. If we don't help these businesses, we won't be getting any revenues in the future. But it was you gave an excellent presentation, and I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for your call, Ruth. Governor?
Yeah, thank you very much. And I just think that we, you know, we have urgent needs right now. I mean, again, these businesses, I talk with them on a daily basis. You probably do as well, Dave, people calling in and just really on the edge of bankruptcy. And if they don't get some assistance right now, we're going to see an incredible cliff coming up where we're losing the very entities that are giving us their lifeblood of government, you know, the revenue needed to disperse and utilize to help other struggling Vermonters. So if we don't have that money, then we're going to have problems in the future. And this is going to be, again, systemic over the next period of years if we don't fix it now. So we need to inject this money right now. We have it available. And I think it's essential. I think it's just philosophical differences with the legislature. I think there are some who want to wait and see if the federal government changes their mind and changes the rules and allows us to use the one part of the $1.25 billion to fill our budget, our budget deficit here in state government. But I think it's short-sighted. And I know that's incredibly hard to fix the budget deficits that we're facing right now. But if we don't do it now and fix it right, then again, it'll be short-sighted, because we'll fix our problem, but then we'll have this systemic problem over the next period of years because we won't have the business support there.
One of the big challenges, as I understand it, and tell me if I've got this wrong, but there's a lot of concern about the education fund, because the education fund, of course, is heavily funded by the sales tax, and of course, with retail just about dead for a few months in Vermont here this year, you know, we've seen a giant hit there. But these federal funds, I understand, are you're barred basically from using them to backfill something like the education fund. And of course, the fear there is that would generate a lot of increases in local property taxes if the education fund comes up short, which it appears right now that it may. And so I guess I'm wondering, how are you pressing folks in Congress to try to to try to get them to change that rule that prevents this money being used for school funding? And secondly, do you feel like, would you be getting support? Seems like you would, from a lot of other states that are basically in the same boat.
Yeah, not all states are in the same boat. I will say that some are in better shape than others, don't have the budget deficits that we do, and others, they had maybe bigger reserves. And we have some reserves as well that we are going to have to utilize. I mean, the rainy day fund was put in place just for this purpose when it starts raining. And I would say we're in a real hurricane right now, a real downpour. So we'll have to use that money. There's going to be a combination of using some of the resources we have now. We're going to have to tighten our belts. Each and every one of us individually has had to do that. Government isn't going to be spared. We're going to have to take our lump, so to speak, as well in the short term. And we'll see. I mean, we have been advocating for as much flexibility in this money as possible. The administration, the Treasury in particular, has set guidelines out that have restricted us in many, many ways, not just from the budget deficit standpoint, but in other ways as well. So that's been frustrating. So I've been advocating, along with other governors, to allow for more flexibility. So let us have better control of the money so that we can put it to best use in our states. We're continuing to advocate for that. Hopefully, we'll get to a point where we can do that. The congressional delegation has been great to work with Senator Leahy, Congressman Wells, Senator Sanders have all tried to advocate for this flexibility. And I assume we'll get there at some point, providing some ability to do more. But it's nothing we can count on. That's why I keep saying we need to first take care of those who take care of us. That's and when I talk about the businesses, I mean, let's be frank here. The businesses provide jobs and opportunities. And if we don't have the businesses, then we don't have the jobs. And so that puts a lot of other folks at risk and more on unemployment. You know, we went from a high of 90,000 plus on unemployment or PUA or some combination of the two. We're down, you know, in the 50,000 mark at this point. Moving in the right direction, but that's still a lot of money. I mean, we went from being the having the lowest unemployment rate in the country when we were talking about less than 5,000 people on unemployment, and now we're at 10 times that amount of money, 10 times that amount at this point. So we need to put people back to work. We need to put businesses back on a better foundation, and we have the means to do so right now. So. They're reaching out. They want a lifeline. They're crying for help. We need to support them.
Speaking of unemployment, certainly earlier on in the pandemic, the Department of Labor was having a real struggle, and I can understand if you suddenly have a 10 or 20-fold increase in the your daily or weekly workload, that's tough to adapt to right real quickly. But I mean, are we up to speed yet? Do you feel like this is a problem that has been brought under control to some extent?
Yeah, no doubt. We were overwhelmed. It was like a tsunami that hit us, and we did all we could in some respect at the time. Looking back, we could have done things differently, and I've learned from that situation. But this point in time, I mean, there was a lot of people working, you know, 7 days a week. On this issue, and we've been able to utilize other call centers and so forth. You know, we've had to hire some out in other states, and that's put things back into perspective. Getting people back to work has reduced the workload. So yes, the bottom line is the calls where we are getting tens of thousands of calls and unanswered calls on a daily basis. Which mm-hmm. is really frustrating for so many. But we're down to, I think the average wait time is under like a minute or two. It may fluctuate depending on the day, but I think it averages out under a minute at this point. So, yes, we've gone through a lot of struggles, but had the help of many, and we're able to get back on the better footing. So we need to, again, focus on other areas at this point.
We have another caller on the line, Forbes from East Corinth. Good morning, Forbes.
How are you? How are you today?
All right. How are you doing?
Political reality here. Phil, you're running for a re-election, aren't you?
I am. I've turned in my ballot, so to speak, and signed back up, but I'm not actively campaigning at this point, imagine, Forbes.
If the legislature can paint you in a negative position, especially on trying to support the small businesses and people that are on the edge, wouldn't that be to their advantage in your reelection?
Well, I don't know what their strategy might be, but I think I'm going to give. I want to defend them in some respects. They just have a different philosophy on what to do with some of this money. You know, $1.25 billion sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But we've had to use, $200 or $300 million of that for the emergency itself. I want to use about $400 million for the economic plan. We need $300 to $400 million to shore up our healthcare system. Then we need some money for education as well, for remote learning and broadband and so forth and so on. So pretty soon we've used up all the money. And what they would like to do is to, they're Again, you probably should ask them. But from my standpoint, from what I've read and they've told me, they want to save some, put some aside in hopes of using it to fill this budget deficit of about $300 to $400 million. So they're going to, you know, keep some of this aside in hopes that the federal government will change its mind and allow for that use of the money. And I just think that's short-sighted from my standpoint. And I know how tough it's going to be to deal with this budget, but that's what we have to do. And if we want to look, you know, a year or two down the road, we have to support these businesses and the jobs they provide for individuals. Otherwise, we're going to be in a much worse position a year or two from now than we are today.
Let's go to Lee from Northfield. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, and good morning, Governor Scott. It's Lee Hatch in Northfield.
Good morning, Lee.
My question, first I'll make a comment. I applaud you for being steadfast and methodical and logical and confident in getting Vermont to where we are. I can't imagine how difficult it is to be blasted from both sides, doing too little, doing too much. But we are right there. We're sailing that ship right with you. So thank you. Thank you. My question has to do, my husband and I, we are both over 60. We have been very careful following all the rules. We have pretty much stayed in our home together. I am furloughed currently, and he is back working very part-time. When we leave the house, we wear masks. We wash our hands. We do all those things that we're supposed to do. We have maintained the integrity of keeping ourselves safe and keeping everybody else safe around us. My question is, we have two teenage grandsons who are actually flying to Vermont tomorrow morning from their home in Georgia, where our son-in-law is in the Navy. They have been holding to a very close quarantine there. They're flying to Vermont. Is it necessary? Do the boys, should we have them quarantine when they arrive here? I'm trying to do it right for them and for everybody else.
I think I have this right. If they quarantine for 14 days there in Georgia before coming, then they won't have to quarantine when they get here. We have issued more guidance on that to relax the restrictions on that, understanding we need to be, you know, use some common sense. Sounds like you've been using all kinds of common sense in your own daily lives, and we're trying to do that for those visitors that we need to come to Vermont. As you probably heard in the press conferences, we've allowed for certain travel between different counties of different states and so forth in the Northeast. We haven't branched out much beyond the Northeast, but we will in the future and identify states that are as safe as we are. But I believe if you go to the ACCD website, I think you'll find it there, and they will give you all the guidance necessary for someone coming from another state. But I think I have that right. If not, I'll check it out today and have someone get in touch with you.
Sure. Okay. That's fine. And I will go. I'll go to that website to be sure, because we do want to follow the rules. We don't want to be playing a part in having anything begin to erupt again. So thank you again for your guidance getting us through this.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for again playing by the rules. If it wasn't for people like Lee and your husband, we would be in a much different position right now, and for the worse. It's because of Vermonters and their ability to step up and do the right thing that we're in a really strong position, stronger than most states. And when we see, you know, we haven't had, 55 deaths is a lot. And on the 19th, we'll be recognizing that, the 19th of every month, recognizing those we've lost as a result. But when you look at other states, and we haven't had a death in almost 3 weeks now. So that's good news. good news because
it is good news. And I will be watching and listening for when the nursing homes and care facilities are open, because that you're among those. My mother is in one, and we have we send letters and we do what we can to stay in contact, but we are not beating down the door saying let us get in. We want her to be safe. We want us to be safe.
Right. We'll be talking about that tomorrow at the press conference and and having a plan to move forward, because we know from the social benefits and mental health aspect, we can't forget that those who are in our long-term care facilities, and we can't punish them. We want to protect them, but we can't punish them, and we need them to have some, you know, the security and well-being of family members.
Yes. Well, and thank you. You're getting us through this with the same steady guidance and principle and ethics as you got us through Irene. And I think the entire state of Vermont should be in your cheering section. So I'll let you go. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Lee. Appreciate it. Governor, a few minutes to go, or do you have a hard stop at 9:30?
I have one in about 2 or 3 minutes. So we have
okay,
two or three minutes.
I just wanted to ask one more question, and it is a shift in topics, and that goes to, you know, police violence, race relations, and all of this. One of the things that has occurred to me over time, and I think we saw it again this weekend, you had more than 200 people turn out for the painting of the mural on State Street on Saturday, and then it took one person, you know, one bad apple Saturday night to vandalize it. In the same way, you know, after the harassment of former Representative Kaya Morris from Bennington, you had hundreds, maybe thousands of Vermonters lending her support and just, you know, stepping up and telling her that, you know, everybody regarded her well and wished her well, et cetera. One guy down in Bennington was harassing her. How do you address this this kind of lone wolf activity out there that seems to pop up in this context, you know, too often? And what do you think about the fairness or unfairness of having one actor essentially tarnish the whole state in a certain way?
Yeah, I think we all have a responsibility to step up. It's not enough anymore. I said this at one of my press conferences. It's not enough to say, I'm not a racist. Most of us don't consider ourselves to be racist. We have to be anti-racist. And we have to step up and call out some of these actions and say it's not okay. You know, it just isn't okay. It's interesting. I don't go on Facebook, but some of my staff has been monitoring some of the comments on my Facebook page, as well as the vandalism we saw on State Street. It's just so disturbing and discouraging and troubling. And it just proves we still have a long ways to go. We have a lot of work to do. But there's more good people than bad people. And again, we have the power in our hands to step up and do the right thing and take actions individually, collectively, and say enough. Enough's enough. And let's change things.
Curtis Reed of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity had him on the show earlier this week, and he was I guess yesterday it was, and he was saying the sort of majority white population which does not consider itself racist has a duty to keep talking to others who may still harbor some racist thoughts. Other white folks, family members or friends or whatever, who occasionally say things that indicate they're not thinking the right way on this stuff, and that we have a duty and we can't remain silent and so on and so forth. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with Curtis. I'll end on this one. I was at a forum. It was last year. It was put on by Change the Story, the Vermont Commission on Women, and it was highlighting gender equity issues. I don't know if you were there, Dave, but a guy named Ted Bunch, who was the presenter, and who's black, and it was the theme was A Call to Men. It was about, you know, being a role model for kids and mentor, better mentors and so forth, being better people. But he was telling the story about his teaching his kids how to drive. And I remember fondly teaching my kids how to drive, you know, and my parents teaching me how to drive
fondly.
And so forth.
Yeah.
And it was just interesting, you know, so it hit home. And so I was thinking about that, and he said, you know, the first thing that I did when I taught my son how to drive was I told him, when you get in the car, you put your wallet on the dash. And I'm thinking, why would you put your wallet on the dash? And I was thinking that would, you know, if you get stopped, would it just keep it handy? Why would you do that? And then he said, because when you get pulled over, if you're reaching in your pockets, you could get shot. And, you know, the first thing from any of our minds when we're teaching our kids how to drive, from my standpoint, is how do we keep our kids from being shot? It's about how do you keep them alive and how do you keep them on the road, but certainly not about the risks associated with that. So it was powerful for me, and it had an impact on me. And I thought we need to put ourselves in their position. Take, like I did with the Vermont Everyday Jobs Tour, put yourself in their shoes for just a minute and look at it through their lens and what they feel, and listen to them. Just listen to their stories. I think it will have a big impact because we take a lot of things for granted. We just do. And it's not our fault. It's just we take a lot of things for granted about how you know, we don't have to. Our race doesn't determine some of these actions.
Yeah, that is really something worth thinking about. I mean, and that really goes to the whole issue of white privilege there, where, you know, so many of these types of thinking, you know, most white folks don't really have to think this way, and unfortunately, people of color often do. So,
yeah,
well, Governor,
white privilege doesn't mean that life is easy for anyone who is white, but it doesn't, you know, determine your race doesn't determine that outcome, and I think that's the difference.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Governor, I really appreciate you giving me this all this time, extra time even this morning. Thank you so much for joining me. It's always good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
You take care. Thank you.
All righty. We're going to go to a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show. When we return, I believe we are going to be speaking with Steve Pappas from the Times-Argus, and we'll be back shortly, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We are back, and thank you very much for staying with us. I think that was an informative and interesting conversation we had with Governor Phil Scott in the first 40 minutes or so of today's program, and I really appreciate the governor giving us a little extra time this morning. We wanted to also bring in this segment Steve Pappas. He is the editor of the Times-Argus and Rutland Herald, and he mentioned to me the other day that there's some news about the news. There's some actually interesting developments happening at the papers, and I believe Steve's on the line with us. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad.
No, go ahead.
There is news about the news. What is the news?
Well, the news is that where lots of newspapers and media organizations are having to continue to make cuts to make ends meet, we have made the decision that we are going to go back to 5 days a week, a publication beginning on June 30th. We cut back from 5 days to 3 days a week in March, around the time mm-hmm. that the pandemic started, as a cost-saving measure, and also laid off quite a few folks from both the Times-Argus and the Rutland Herald. And while we're not bringing everybody back at once, we are beginning a phased-in return to the staff, and we are, like I said, going back to 5 days a week, which is, you know, we see it very much as a sign of folks' commitment in the community to the papers. We're seeing an uptick in subscribers in both the print and online products, which has been tremendous. And, you know, we don't know if people are feeling like they need to be informed or they might be bored, but either way, well, we're more than happy to have them picking up both papers, the Times Argus and the Rutland Herald. And then we are rolling out we made a very conscientious effort that we want to help businesses that have been affected by the pandemic. And so in consultation with our parent company, Sample News Group, the two papers are engaging in what we're calling a marketing relief program. And we are going to be providing a match of advertising dollars of up to $100,000 between now and the end of August to various businesses that are struggling to get back on their feet, so that if they, as we build their ad program, we will be providing them with an equal amount of space in the paper so they can either have larger ads or a greater frequency of ads. When they plunk down their money, we will match it dollar for dollar in column inches or on our websites. And, you know, we know that people need that hand right now, and that to be able to kind of get the word out that they are back, and they may not be back at full steam, but that in the recovery they are also phasing in. And, you know, we see this as our job as community builders and partners in the community of you know, helping people, small business owners, get a leg up to, you know, to grow back. And obviously an investment in the paper, we feel like an investment in the paper is an investment in the community right now. And, you know, a lot of folks are struggling. So this is a great way to be working with local businesses across Vermont to, you know, to get people up and running again. And so, you know, we're very excited. I honestly didn't think that we were going to be able to make an announcement about going back to 5 days, and a lot of people had written us off when we went down to three. Mm-hmm. Not the case. So we're feeling pretty emboldened and feeling really good that people have felt like we have tried to make ourselves indispensable and be the center of community, and, you know, a lot of folks have responded in kind. So we're very excited.
Well, congratulations. First off, as, you know, a longtime journalist myself, more journalism, the better, in my humble estimation. And, and you know, I have been a longtime subscriber to the Times Argus and have really been a fan of your organization, both at the Times Argus and the Herald. I mean, I remember back during my years at the AP in the 80s and 90s, I used to think it was kind of amazing to me the degree to which those papers had this tradition of really, it looked like, you know, I never saw the books or anything, but it certainly looked like to me that there was a tradition there of basically pouring a lot of the profits from the paper, or, you know, that the papers were making back into the product, you know. And so these tiny little papers, by national standards, maintaining, say, a three-person statehouse bureau back in those days, you know, was always really impressive to me. And, you know, and I know that's not currently the case because of just all the other storms that have hit the media in the last 20 or 30 years now. But it is still something that, you know, I think a lot of Vermonters have a long time fond associations with your company. So you know, and to see it emerging in this way from the pandemic, I think is just really it's encouraging. You know, it's something that you know, three cheers and rock on and whatever else.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah. Well, and thank you. A lot of people say that it's a testament to the resilience of the paper. And again, this is a testament to our communities, and that we all, you know, have a lot of faith in one another. And there's, you know, there is that expression about the rising tide lifting all ships. And, you know, we're certainly not declaring mission accomplished or victory over COVID, but we are very much feeling like we can build back to that next step where community journalism matters. And by the way, newspapers across the country, small newspapers across the country, have found themselves to be at the center of community. They have become very indispensable, and people want to see a human face to this pandemic. It is such a grind and so hard to get through all the time. And when you can give it a face, like a Dave Graham in our Five Questions With a few weeks ago, that all of a sudden, you know, these are our neighbors. These are our friends. These are the folks who, we don't feel as alone in the struggle. And
Steve, interesting editorial this morning about Pride Week. And I love the editorial page of the Times Argus. So, talk about an engaged citizenry. The letters are oftentimes just really, really fascinating. And frankly, there are quite a number of good writers out there around Vermont. But your editorial pointed to Pride Week. So tell us a little bit about that. What was all that about?
Well, it probably has less to do with Pride Week. It just happens to be that this is Pride Week across the nation, which is the celebration of the LGBTQ community. And yesterday's historic decision by the U.S. Supreme Court saying that the LGBT community is entitled to the same benefits as workers, as all other individuals. That affirmation was worth an editorial in my mind, and given the fact that Vermont has played a pivotal role in kind of raising awareness about civil unions back in the day, and the issues associated with that. Over time, we felt like it was important to kind of put into writing that we were very pleased to see that decision come, and that maybe it was providing a little bit of hope that people are thinking more broadly, and not all people, but some people are thinking more broadly and making decisions that definitely benefit the greater good, because it certainly feels like there are a lot of decisions being made right now that are about dismantling what we're all trying to accomplish in society, and or take it in a different direction. And it's worthy praise in our book.
You know, it's really interesting to me. This is an issue, basically, gay rights, same-sex marriage, et cetera. This bundle of issues, 20 years ago, I remember Howard Dean saying that, quote, "I'm uncomfortable with it just like anyone else." This is after the Vermont Supreme Court decision, basically calling on the legislature to fashion something like marriage for same-sex couples. And to see the shift in attitudes across the political spectrum about this, to me, is just amazing. And it frankly, I think it might give you hope that some of these other issues we've been grappling with more recently about race, for instance, and sexism and the Me Too movement, et cetera, that change is possible. That you can change social attitudes. I remember in the exit poll in 2000, the state was exactly divided, 49-49 in the AP exit poll, which I was sort of managing at the time, and for Vermont. By 84, it was something like 80-something% either in favor of civil unions or full marriage. So change happens, and that's there you go. Anyway, Steve Pappas, we are about out of time, unfortunately. A short segment with you this time. We'll give you the full boat next time.
Okay,
how's that?
No worries.
All right.
Yeah.
Really appreciate you joining me. Okay.
Yeah.
And we are going to go to a top of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. We're going to be talking to one of our CBS News correspondents right afterward, and then a discussion about making sure that kids are well protected in Vermont following that. So stay with us, folks.
Mm-hmm.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and thanks for staying with us into the second hour of our program on this Tuesday morning, June the 16th, 2020. And we have with us for the next few minutes, Paul Vialis of CBS News, and he's going to be talking to us about the latest news on the police violence front, I guess is one way to describe it. Good morning, Paul. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. Always a pleasure. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Good, thank you.
So this news out of Atlanta, obviously very very disturbing. One question I've been hearing and seeing some of online is sort of goes to whether this officer who shot the gentleman in Atlanta there is as much at fault or is as culpable as the officer in Minneapolis, the officers in Minneapolis who killed George Floyd there, or, you know, I mean, obviously there are sort of gradations of these things, maybe, and I'm wondering
between the two.
Go ahead.
No comparison between the two, Dave. Absolutely not. And to break that down for your listeners so we understand, let's take Minneapolis. Minneapolis case, they're responding to what's alleged as passing forged money.
Mm-hmm.
They get there. He's relatively cooperative. They handcuff him. They put him in the back of the car. And then they take him out of the car, put him on the ground after he was already in control, and put a knee to the back of the neck. That's murder with intent. No question. No comparison. Now let's go to Atlanta. Look at Atlanta and break Atlanta down because it's sort of like the quintessential perfect storm from the legal side, the policy side, and the police discretion side. You have a guy who's passed out in front of the wheel. You get him to the side. You park the car. He comes out. He's cooperative. Yes, sir. No, sir. He's respectful. He's coherent. He doesn't appear to be rambling. But yet now you see that he's blown over the legal limit of .08. So it's your decision now. Do I arrest him for DUI? This comes down to the police discretion side. He decides to arrest him. As he goes to handcuff him, both cops are sloppy. If those were my cops back in the day, I can tell you right now we'd be having words. Because once you decide to arrest somebody, you take firm control of that individual. They were sloppy. He broke free. That led to him taking the taser, to running, turning, pointing, shooting, or pointing the taser at the officer from a distance, running, and the officer shooting him in the back. Now we come down to use of force. Use of force. Matrix clearly says the officer can go one step above that which the force is being presented to him. So taser is an impact weapon in the state of Georgia. It's considered a deadly weapon. And the officer then returns fire. Legally, as much as no one wants to hear this, legally they're going to come back that the officer was justified. Policy-wise, procedure-wise, not the smart move whatsoever. And therein lies then the third point of that perfect storm being police discretion, which I think has gone out the window. So two different cases, two entirely different cases.
And talk to me a little bit about the role the current environment plays in the reaction to this event in Atlanta.
You know, it plays a lot, obviously. I mean, it shouldn't. We should be across the board all the time. But it plays a lot. We go up there and let's revisit that scene in Atlanta. You know what's going on. You came out of roll call a couple of hours ago. You got briefed on what's going on in the country. And now you come up to a situation when you have this individual, you have two white cops, you have a black suspect, and he's cooperative. He's unarmed. Mm-hmm. And he does not pose a threat to the community.
Yep.
Police discretion. Do I arrest him or not? Okay, you decide to arrest him. Let's just say they decided not to arrest him. The car's parked. I have your keys. I have your license. I can't lock. I can lock you up right now for DUI. I'm electing to give you a shot. Have someone pick you up or walk home. You come up tomorrow, I'll give you the keys. I'll give you the license. Now, you have no threat to the community. You have not jeopardized yourself. You've exercised positive discretion, and you've eliminated any kind of threat. So, to me, that's the other side of this equation. And that comes down to exercising discretion.
Boy, don't you wish it had gone the other way? Yikes.
Well, you know what? Having been there, and then when I my last post, I was the CEO of the State Police Academy, and the thing that I taught my cops all the time, the most powerful weapon you have is your mouth.
Yeah.
And if you can talk your way down, smart move. And, you know, it for 40 years of public service in this country, both at the city and state and also at the federal level, you know, I can say unequivocally it worked brilliantly for me and has worked well for the tens of thousands of cops that I trained.
Yeah. I guess we need more trainers like you out there in the field because, you know, this is stuff that is, I mean, really crucial second to second decision making here. And of course, you know, you're going to have the best, you're going to have the best decisions being made in the moment if you have good training. And, I mean, it's almost like a sport, you know, I mean,
exactly.
You know, you're out on the basketball court and you make, you know, the right move defensively, or you make the right way of going to the hoop or whatever. And the reason for that is because you've practiced it 1,000 times and your coach has yelled at you for doing it wrong, 500 of them. And that's basically, you know, the way this kind of stuff seems like ought to work. And unfortunately, you know, it seems like a lot of times these guys are out there and they don't have the level of training that they really need. In that, I mean, yeah, and I guess your point about them being sloppy, they probably were borderline. Do we arrest this guy or not, or do we give him a semi pass?
And Dave, when you watch the video and you listen to it, that's exactly where they were, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
When you make look, if I'm going to arrest you, as soon as I say in my mind, all right, I'm locking him up. I position my body physically so that I have the easiest way of gaining control of you. If you get out of control, I can use various techniques to gain control. Mm-hmm. And the moment I put my arm on you, I can assure you, you know you're going to jail. So you're either in or you're out. You can't be half pregnant on that. You know?
I mean, I shouldn't laugh. This is such a tragic situation, but your expression there is I mean, pretty apt. And I think I think is just one of these. And so, you know, the police chief resigns and the...
It's the problem, though.
Yeah, and people are calling for these officers to be charged. You don't think they will be, or this officer?
Well, no.
What
I believe to be true is that the politicians in the city of Atlanta are going to do everything they can to charge him. Now, GBI, Georgia Bureau of Investigations, is a top flight organization. So, you know, we'll see what they say on this. But at the end of the day, this comes down to several things. They have the use of force matrix. Did he use the force he was entitled to, especially in accordance with Georgia state law?
Mm-hmm.
And can they articulate that he felt that he was in imminent fear of bodily injury, great bodily injury, or death from this person, or that he was a threat to the community? You know, they're going to have a hard time proving against the cop on this one, I hate to say.
Well... Yeah, I mean, we'll have to see how it comes out. I just have the sense of it's a darn shame that you know the timing of this thing. And I mean, I do think that the climate right now is such that it was really just a bad time. I mean, these kinds of incidents will happen. Everybody, you know, we're dealing with human beings here. Occasionally, people react in ways you wish they didn't. You know, I mean, I wish that the guy had just stayed down and had not tried to reach for the taser and grab the taser and go running off and firing it, you know, and obviously then bad again, reaction on his part. So,
right. Then again, you know, we need to understand part of police reform is the community's responsibility to take ownership of over a portion of that. And if the community thinks that they're going to sit back and let the police do all the work, you're sorely mistaken. Nothing's going to get accomplished. community leaders, if they are real leaders and they're just not there to, you know, promote themselves and their personal interests, then they'll make sure that their community understands that they have a part in this too. And both need to work together, as in any relationship, which this is. This can be fixed, but it's going to require both the police and the community to work at it.
Well, a lot of work to do, it sounds like, on both sides, maybe. So
there is, but it's certainly doable, Dave.
All right. Well, Paul Vialis, really thank you for your insights this morning. It's good talking with you, and let's do it again soon.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Dave.
All righty. I think we have a caller on the line. Is it Jeff from Hinesburg with us?
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I just want to make a couple of points. First off, where you guys were just talking about the discretion of the officer, you know, do we let them go? Do we not let them go? Hey, I took his keys. I took his license, whatever. Okay. Now, let me put this situation to you, okay? That person is me, okay? I get back in my car and I go, ha ha, I got them. I got a spare key. I get in my car. I start driving down the road, Dave, and then I meet your wife or your children. I get in an accident and I kill them. You're going to go back onto that police department and say, hey, you had a chance to take this guy to jail. He blew over the limit. You let him get back in his car to supposedly sleep, being the good guys. How's that going to go over? Okay, it's not going to go over well.
No.
So as far as that goes, there is a no tolerance policy as far as DWI and being drunk behind the wheel, and it has to stay that way. And I'm not saying it has to be that way with all circumstances, but I'm just saying in this circumstance when it comes to being drunk behind the wheel, it has to be a no tolerance. You know, to me, there is no discretion. It's you're drunk, you got to go to jail. And then secondly, I just wanted to point out to a lot of people, Dave, I've been a part of a couple of protests. I support the movements that are going on. I do not support the slogan of Black Lives Matter for two reasons. One, I think Black Lives Matter is becoming politicized and it's becoming used in a way that it wasn't originally designed for. And I also believe that it doesn't fully address the problem. It's not just Black Lives that are getting harassed right now. It's all non-white lives. And that is what I protest and that is what I support. Is all non-lives need are all non-white lives need help. You know, we can't just focus on Black lives. We have to focus on all non-white, because racism is happening across the board with every race, and to just focus on one doesn't really solve the problem.
Well, my take on that slogan "Black Lives Matter" is that. You know, and I know the response to it is often all lives matter. I'll tell you that as a longtime journalist, I never wrote a headline that said "Dawn expected tomorrow," because that would not qualify as news. By the same token, I don't think the phrase "all lives matter" qualifies as news. Meanwhile, unfortunately, to too many people, the phrase "Black Lives Matter" does qualify as news. That's why people are focusing on it and uttering it, and I do think that sometimes you really kind of need to let people express themselves in the way they feel a need to, you could say, sure, Native American lives matter and Asian lives matter and Inuit lives matter, you know, all non-white, you know, your point here is all non-white lives should be.
And that's exactly what I'm trying to get out is that, you know, racism is happening across, you know, the Asian Americans, the Hispanic Americans, the Native American Americans. It's not just, you know, the African American Americans that are right now being profiled. Yes, they're the ones that seem to be in the spotlight, you know, unfortunately, because of a few bad cops, you know, but it's, you know, if we're going to make the change, it needs to be made, you know, universally, not, you know, just on one certain spot.
Yeah. I agree with that to that extent. I will say there, you know, in addition to these considerations, you do have to keep in mind the history, 400 years of racism and Jim Crow and, you know, Ku Klux Klan activity and all the rest of this, which I do think that there are, you know, racism, unfortunately, is a more widespread phenomenon in society than would focus just on one race. But I do think that there's plenty of work to do here. And, you know, maybe we finish this project and then get to the next one. I don't know. But anyway, I got to jump. Jeff, thank you for the call. And we'll hope to hear from you soon. Let's see. We are, I think, about to start a new segment here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And wanted to bring in some folks to talk about how Vermont's kids are doing, particularly vulnerable kids and kids who have been, you know, basically in troubled families, et cetera. There's just an amazing amount of work that goes on in this state every day and really around the country, but and probably around the world in many, many places. But working with families and trying to end things like child abuse, just incredibly important work. And hats off to folks who are doing it day in and day out. And they and the way they have to kind of maintain, you know, a positive and uplifting attitude in the face of some really, really difficult circumstances sometimes. Layered on that now, we have this pandemic where, and the difficulty, you know, you have social distancing and you have a lot of folks who are trying to work remotely and so on and so forth. And so, so many different aspects of the human services fields have been upended, just as many, many other fields have been upended by the pandemic. But I wanted to focus on this in particular because I think the challenges here already were incredibly high before the pandemic, and here with the pandemic are just even that much more so. So, a long way of introducing my next guests, who are Linda Johnson of Prevent Child Abuse of Vermont. Craig Pinkham is with the Washington County Youth Service Bureau, and Brenda Gooley is with the State Department for Children and Families. And the three of you, I very much appreciate you joining me this morning. I think all of you are on the line, if I understand correctly.
Yes, and thank you, Dave.
Linda, let me start with you and sort of ask you to just either confirm or deny that I sort of got what I was just talking about right, roughly, that this pandemic has really, you know, as it's thrown a curveball at so many people, it has certainly done that in your work. And tell us a little bit about that, if that's the case.
Sure. Well, normally we do parent support groups and we do nurturing parenting programs, which are parent education courses. And we train early childhood educators and everyone in human services working with children and families who are on the young side in child sexual abuse prevention. And then we do shaken baby syndrome prevention training for anybody and everybody across the board. Medical folks and human service folks and parents and just about everyone. But in fact, you know, meeting with people in person is out of the question right now and has been for some months. So we pivoted to everything we do being online. And much to our amazement, it's working really well.
That actually is kind of amazing. And maybe Brenda Gooley, you could shed some further light on this. You know, and talk to me if this is just my own prejudice or whatever, but I sort of have had the understanding that, you know, many of the families experiencing abuse of various kinds or who are at risk here tend to be lower income families, and that many lower income families are on the wrong side of the famous digital divide. In other words, they don't have the latest computer technology and maybe not the fastest internet connections and all of that kind of thing. Some families don't have any of that stuff. When you shift this work to an online environment, what happens there?
Well, what I would say is certainly you're correct that there's a significant percentage of families involved with the Family Services Division of DCF that are in poverty or at risk of being in poverty. And access to the internet can certainly be a challenge. At the same time, over the last few months, there have been significant community efforts to increase access to the internet and Wi-Fi. And so a much higher percentage of families are on the internet now. And I would say for families and for staff, a much higher comfort level using technology, using virtual platforms as a way to connect. And I would echo Linda's point that we've actually experienced better engagement with families, so families feeling more comfortable connecting with the Family Services Division staff in a virtual platform like Zoom or Skype. So those ways of connecting with families through the internet can actually be a bridge to developing a relationship and developing trust and capacity to be a helpful presence in that family's life.
Well, that's fascinating, because I would think that if you can get the folks online and get them used to fairly facile with this technology and deliver some of these services online, one thing you're going to do is mitigate another big challenge, especially common to low-income families in Vermont or anywhere else, really, and that's transportation. Because, I mean, I know if you have a meeting with your counselor scheduled, you got to get there at normal times. I mean, that was sort of and that could be a real barrier in many, many instances. Is that the case, or am I off the rails there?
Yes, I mean, I will say it's been a pretty a really powerful shift, an unexpected shift, that we have actually been able to connect families more effectively to some of their natural support network. So, for example, if a family has an auntie out in California or a grandparent that lives a couple hundred miles away that otherwise was not able to really be a part of that safety net for the child and family, they are able to connect on a virtual platform, again, like Zoom or Skype, and that has created these new opportunities for connection, even things like connecting foster parents with parents to talk about parent-child contact. Having that meeting occur virtually can be a way that feels safer and more comfortable for everyone involved. And you don't have to worry about transportation. You don't have to worry about arranging for childcare. You're able to just get people together very easily. And so we did not expect this, and we've actually learned that we have some new tools at our disposal to really support families. It's just an unexpected benefit coming out of this COVID experience.
Wow, that's fascinating. And I suppose if you're having a Zoom meeting at 3 o'clock or something, that maybe that's even in some ways a more special category of time spending, you know, than just kind of having grandma come over and hang out for a day. You know, it's more concentrated or whatever, and you can actually maybe get some things done. But speaking of conversations that get things done, we're going to continue ours after a bottom of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show for some CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors. My guests are Brenda Gooley. Brenda, what's your title with DCF?
I'm the Director of Operations for the Family Services Division of DCF.
Got it. Okay. Craig Pinkham is the director of the Washington County Youth Service Bureau, and we'll get you into the conversation after the break. Craig, don't worry. And Linda Johnson is with Prevent Child Abuse Vermont, and we'll be back with these three guests very shortly, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We are back and continuing our conversation with Craig Pinkham of the Washington County Youth Service Bureau, Linda Johnson of Prevent Child Abuse Vermont, and Brenda Gooley, who is with the Family Services Division of the Vermont Department for Children and Families. And Craig Pinkham of the Washington County Youth Services Bureau, correct me if I am wrong here, but I sort of have the impression that you work mainly with people who are maybe of a slightly older age group than the average for someone like Linda Johnson. I picture Linda talking more to families with young children, and you would be, Craig, working with maybe teenagers how am I doing so far? Am I close?
Probably close enough. I won't speak for how Linda will characterize the services of Prevent Child Abuse Vermont, because I think it's complicated. But we certainly work with youth who are aged between 12 and 20, 24, 25, sort of in that ever evolving range of how you define the upper end of youth.
I got it. Okay, and that is evolving. It's fascinating how that has happened generation to generation. That's not really the main topic here, though. But I wanted to sort of focus you for a moment anyway on dealing with the pandemic. And it sounds like from what Brenda was saying that in certain respects technology may be making this work. I don't know if easier is the right word, but it actually seems to be working out pretty well from what I'm hearing from Brenda. Would you say that's the case for you as well?
Well, I think what I would say is I'll qualify that a little bit and say that I think what we're all learning, and I would agree with both Brenda and Linda that that we've all been surprised at how effective these tools can be. But I think it's important to stress at the same time that what we're finding is that they're tools. They're not long-term solutions. I think they're helping us to deal with the current moment. And I also think that we're going to emerge from the pandemic with a new set of tools in our box that will help to, alleviate some of the transportation issues that you've alluded to and some of the connectivity, long-range connectivity issues that Brenda related, brought up. But the reality is we are social. We're social beings. And I think especially working with youth, who are in a part of their life, a phase of their life, where one of the developmental tasks is to figure out how to socialize well. I think, at the same time, what we're finding is that it's not going to be a substitute for getting back to or at least longing for a return to that face-to-face contact. I think when we started this conversation, about how we were going to be as an agency, there was a lot of conversation about really moving into a place where, we're using technology and the youth are already familiar with it. They're already operating in that world. And I think while that's true to some point, we've also found in some ways that youth have the same degree of Zoom fatigue that we all have. They have the same sort of longing for being able to go outside and be in a park with your friends, be face-to-face with someone who is a helper and a supporter to you. And that's still going to be important as we sort of emerge through this. So I agree. It's a great tool. We're finding really good uses for it. And I think some of it will extend beyond this. But it's also at the same way, ironically affirming that the importance of being social and the fact that it's okay that we all miss that.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm contrasting this a little bit with some conversations I've had recently with educators who seem to be, I mean, the ones I've spoken to, I don't know, I can't say it's unanimous. Obviously, I haven't polled every teacher in Vermont or anything, but I'm hearing from a lot of educators that, they feel like for all the talk over the years that maybe distance learning would be playing a larger role in our educational system, it really has not been the best for just, getting material information to students in our schools, and I had a couple of elementary school teachers on a few weeks ago who were saying that they really are missing and think the kids are missing the sort of social emotional aspects of learning, just, you know, how to get along with the kid in the next seat, basically in your classroom, and that kind of thing. And so, is there a difference? Would you say, I'll put this question to you, Linda Johnson. Is there a difference between that experience and the kind of work you do, which I know is, it's certainly not typically in a classroom setting. It's more individualized. But tell me about that. Do you see a contrast there?
Well, for us, we really haven't been able to work directly with the children during this pandemic. So we're primarily, parent-focused. And for parents to meet one another from all across the state over a GoToMeeting or a Zoom has been kind of different. I mean, we're usually very geographically centered. So it would be the Bennington support group, or it would be the St. Albans Nurturing Parenting Program for Families in Recovery. But now, these programs are open to parents from all over the state. And so people are meeting one another from all over the state. And in some ways, that has an advantage in that, you're not going to meet your next door neighbor in this group. And maybe that would be uncomfortable.
Hmm.
Now you're meeting people who you're, unlikely to know in any context of your life. And you can be very honest very quickly and also accept and give great support to one another very, very easily. So it has been quite a surprise, quite a learning experience for us all. And we think that going forward, after the pandemic goes away or subsides or whatever it's going to do, we think we'll probably end up with a mix of programming that will take advantage of what we've learned. And again, transportation, no longer an issue. And we'll also want to do face-to-face because, as Craig so beautifully said, we are human beings, and human beings long for that connection and contact and that social time in person together, which is so important. And, of course, we want to work with the whole family, as we've always done. So,
You make a really interesting point, though, Linda, which is it hadn't occurred to me before. But I another advantage I could see to an online meeting like this is that that you could actually intentionally set it up to be more anonymous and more, if those are key goals, more private, frankly, because. I know that in my own work as a journalist and now a radio host, my wife is a registered nurse, and and it's just when there are all these overlapping relationships in a small community like Central Vermont, where you end up sort of knowing people who in a couple of different contexts, I would imagine that for you. If you're dealing with, two or three different families who live on the same street in the same town, privacy issues really would rear their head much more in that case than they would if you are having a meeting with somebody from Bennington and somebody from St. Johnsbury and somebody from Swanton or something. So is that another advantage, and could these meetings be designed in a way to try to play that, to enhance that advantage?
I think that they can be, and they are, and that'll be good for some of the groups, some of the time. But as Craig said, we do want to get back to face-to-face. There is a value in that is really so important and intangible, but intrinsic to being human beings. I mean, we have a great longing for connection and for warmth of friendship. And part of the purpose of this group is to give families a support system that they can rely upon going into the future. And that means community. That means knowing one another in other contexts. And going forward with more strength and resilience because of it.
Brenda Gooley's from the Family Services Division at DCF. Do you find your staff there, are they better able to sort of check in with families and make rounds basically more easily than when you can do it online? I mean, it just seems like there'd be more opportunities that way to set up appointments. You know, less travel, less knocking on the door and finding out, darn, they aren't home after all, that sort of stuff.
Well, I think what I would say is that there is a mix of benefit of the online platforms, and there are some challenges with the inability to be in person. So, for example, a worker going into the home to assess, you know, what is needed, what are the risks, they're really able to, you know, talk with individuals, read body language, see the details of the home environment, and that that really helps them to form a good assessment of, you know, what is it that is going to help this family to be, you know, a safe, healthy, strong environment for the children. That can be compromised in a world where, you know, we're not in person. At the same time, those virtual platforms may pose an opportunity to connect with a family that we otherwise might not be as likely to successfully connect with. So I think the natural evolution, my greatest hope is that we move forward with a blend and we take the lessons learned, we take the benefits of utilizing things like Zoom and Skype to be able to have those connections and engage, you know, a wider number of family members that are, you know, further away in California, things like that. And at the same time, we are able to, you know, safely return to some face-to-face contact with families. Because I do think that, you know, we are all experiencing the loss of, you know, the impact of COVID and the isolation that occurred because of the, you know, needing to follow those health recommendations to keep us all safe.
You know, actually, that's a really good point that occasionally you do need eyes on the home environment. In particular, I remember years ago there was a great Frederick Weissman documentary about child protection workers in Maine. And I remember one of the cases involved a person going out to, you know, the home of a impoverished family, which was had a ton of basically hazardous waste around, different jars and bottles and cans of chemicals that you did not want kids to be getting into. You know, that's the kind of thing that probably wouldn't show up in a Skype meeting, but would to a social worker going to visit the home, and then you can address the safety issues there just on, you know, having seen something like that. So I definitely understand why, you know, you'd want still to have some of that face-to-face visitation because those issues do arise. Is that right?
Right. And what we've seen as well is not just our eyes on, but child care providers, teachers, you know, many of the individuals who are part of the safety net for children and youth who see them every day in school settings, you know, they're not seeing them every day, you know, because of COVID. And so we've seen starting the third week in March, a 50% reduction in the number of calls of concern to our child protection hotline and subsequently the number of accepted reports where we're able to then send a worker out to the home. And so that dramatic reduction in the number of families that are being brought to our attention is at a time in society where we know families are under a lot more stress because of unemployment, because of isolation, because of all of the stressors that COVID has represented for all of us. And so this is, it's a worrisome time in that way. And we've spent a good bit of time and energy putting out tip sheets for childcare providers and teachers and other individuals who we know are such a vital part of the safety net for vulnerable children and youth about how, even though you may not be seeing this child every day, you may be interacting with them on that virtual platform, and that that's still an opportunity to just check in and ask, how are you doing? How are things going at home? Do you need any help? You know, what's different? What's the same? And just create those opportunities to let the child and family know, I'm here for you. I care about you. If there are ways I can help, I want to be a part of that. Because those efforts make a huge difference in helping all of us to be able to really be a part of supporting families that really do need our help.
Yeah, actually, that is a really key point, I think, because the folks you're talking about are, I hear them described as mandatory reporters, meaning if they do see a problem, they are supposed to tell your agency about it. For instance, Brenda Gooley, and obviously if they are not able to see the child they actually lay eyes on, then, oftentimes things like bruises or whatever will be missed. Am I right about that?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Mm. And the three of you were talking about how, you know, as Brenda just mentioned, these increasing stressors on families, the unemployment, the isolation, the just basically being cooped up altogether at home with fewer opportunities to, you know, for individual family members to, I don't know, go out and go bowling or something. It really has been a big stressor in a lot of households, and could possibly have triggered, you know, additional numbers of abuse cases. In fact, that was what Mr. Thibault said he was finding in terms of the criminal charges coming into his office as state's attorney. And do you feel like that has continued to increase, or do you feel like it's leveled off now? Have folks gotten a handle on these things? And where are we these days as spring turns to summer here?
Well, it's difficult to say because life is happening behind closed doors still for the most part. Mm-hmm. Our 1-800-CHILDREN number, which is the Vermont Parents Helpline, doubled in numbers of calls the first couple of months and now has really started to vastly decrease. And that is a concern. We don't know if that's because people feel they're freer to get out, child care is reopening, there are more bright spots on the horizon for individual freedom and for being part of another family's pod or what. But we do want parents to know there's support at the other end of the line for 1-800-CHILDREN. And we also have a parents' corner, a blog for parents on our website, pcavt.pcavt.org. We just don't know. I mean, really, Brenda and your colleagues, you're going to know before we do probably how things have turned out for children during this time. And Craig, you as well, for so many teens. And we do know that there's unprecedented access to online predators, to children, really, online predators, because kids are on the internet so much and have to be and had to be for school. So we do our best to train every adult that is with children about how to protect kids from online predators and make sure that kids are supervised and share that access with the parents that are caring for them. So we are worried. There's no question about it. The hotline calls, the warm line calls we've received are actually many of them pretty dramatic. And this really cuts across all socioeconomic, lines 100%. That said, the biggest stressor that parents tell us about is food insecurity and money. So poverty does take a toll.
I just got the warning here. a little later than usual. We are actually just about out of time. I want to thank my three guests, Linda Johnson of Prevent Child Abuse Vermont, Craig Pinkham of the Washington County Youth Service Bureau, Brenda Gooley of the Department for Children and Families. Thank the three of you very much for joining me and supporting an important conversation. It's going to about do it for the Dave Graham Show. Tune in again tomorrow for another edition of our program. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and have a good day, everybody.